Blog Talk Radio.
Is that what? Yes, this is Dr. David Payton, and it's a blog, and this is my first one ever, so you'll have to forgive me if I'm not doing this very well. But I'm very excited about this because this is an opportunity to talk about the book I wrote called Second Sight: Views from an Eye Doctor's Odyssey. And I've got with me a friend who is an old friend named Marsha Gowan, whose husband is a lawyer, a distinguished lawyer, and he went to college with me. And I've known Marsha for some years. And also Allison Flatow. And Allison Flatow is a professor of engineering at the University of Maryland, and a person whose engineering interests brought her to the eye, both for its anatomy and physiology, which was fascinating to me. So she's approaching this from another viewpoint, and Marsha's approaching it from a semi-layman's interest, but she also was a co-founder of a ambulatory surgical center in New York and Manhattan some years ago, and she's been the proprietor and assessor of its record and so on for some years. So she's very much involved in knowledge about what eye doctors do and their surgery and so on. So that makes it great. So welcome to Marsha and to Allison. And let me just, why don't you start off with a question and let's get to that.
I was going to say, it's Marsha here. I was going to say, thank you, David. That was a gracious introduction. I wasn't a co-founder, but I certainly was extremely involved in the surgery center. And just from my perspective, when I read this book, I can, I'm very delighted on lots of levels, but certainly the personal level. It's a very interesting read, and a wonderful tale of a young boy and the man's adventures, nationally and internationally, and his focus when it reached eye care.
Great, I loved hearing that.
I was going to say this is Allison, and I'll chime in also that as you mentioned, I'm an engineer, so for me it's a fun treat. It was a fabulous read, and I love the introductory part where you got into your growing up history. It was just fun. I love the it struck me like historical fiction, but it's not. It's real. And so this was just a lot of fun. It was nicely written, fun to read. I know both of us have some questions, and hopefully we'll get some blog questions too. And thank you for the kind introduction also.
Yeah, I must say those are two very kindly introductory comments from you. Somebody's asked me, why did I choose Second Sight? And maybe I better explain that just briefly. Obviously, Second Sight refers to looking back in one's past, but Second Sight for an ophthalmologist is when somebody who used to have glasses for reading finds that he no longer reads those glasses. And the reason is, he takes them off and he can read better without the glasses, and he looks in the distance, seems to see just as well. He says, God, my eyes are getting better. Second Sight. Well, it really isn't Second Sight, because that happens when the eye begins to develop cataracts. That's almost always the only reason. So Second Sight can be a warning sign, and it's now that cataracts can be well taken care of surgically. Nevertheless, it's an indicator that things are changing in the eye, and I thought that would be an appropriate way to name my memoir, if you follow me.
I also thought it was a wonderful thing, David, because you certainly with some of the bumps in the road along your past, at the end sort of the book, you really both forgive people that perhaps were not friendly and certainly not professional perhaps at the end, but also people who were discredited by their own colleagues, and yet in the end you give him quite credit for being Dr. Kelman.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Kelman, I want to get to that in a moment, but thank you, Marsha, for those words. But, you know, I think one of the guiding principles of writing a memoir has to be you have to do a lot of soul searching and be very, very frank, both with yourself and in fairness to others, try to see it from their point of view also. And I tried very hard to do that. For example, there was a person who really was the instigator of the takeover of Orbis for me. And he was like me in that he had a father, a prominent father, with whom he was trying to stay up or to keep up, to please him, or at least in his own mind to feel that he was justified the well-born presence that he had, an Englishman and a very good speaker and an enthusiast and somebody who really made great contributions to Orbis. So I could sympathize with him. He had a tremendous ambition, and I was in the way of that ambition, and he ultimately died sadly from a disorder that was something out of his own control. You know, I can understand that now, but I got to say, along the way, as it happened, when I was deeply depressed by that circumstance, and I make no bones about that in the book, it was not fun, and it was not very easy to be momentarily forgiving. That's the advantage of second sight.
Yes, that's, I must say, that's what I sort of picked up.
Well,
I was also interested, David, in the very beginning of it. You went very early on in your life thinking of the globalization of eye care and health care in particular, and bringing it to the third world countries or the underserved, whatever.
Yeah, I was so thrilled when my father took me to Iran.
And was that your first step?
1948. Well, that was my first step as into eye care stuff. I had a little experience abroad before, but that was the first time I saw people with really terrible eye disease and in great need of care and help and instrumentation and stuff. And it was there because of a hoax that had been was trying to be foisted on the government at that time, the Shah. And my dad was the person who was able to solve that. And watching him do that and seeing how the effect of a project of that nature was really a resounding effect in me over the years, having started with that precedent. And he was a great mentor to me. I was very lucky, very lucky. Mm. But I want to know this, and Allison or either one of you, but Allison, I mentioned her because of she being a doctor of engineering. I wonder, what are the other audiences? Is there another audience for this book, or is it just for people who might like to read a memoir now and then? I was hoping it had a different. I was hoping it had a broader interest than that.
I think it's got several different audiences, and I'm going to start with one example. Was that when I got the book, I got it to read on a plane trip that I was taking with my mom, and she picked it up, and I didn't get it back until she was done, which was 2 days later.
To
it
your
was,
mom.
Yeah,
I'm instant like of her. Well, what do you think about people interested in the healthcare business? I mean, any of the healthcare professions. See, we've gotten a bum rap in healthcare in recent decades, I think. With technology comes a lot of duress and record keeping and other things that come with high volume of patient care, and there are a lot of things that seem to take the humanity out of medicine. And I wanted to show that it's still there, and also that one can build a career in healthcare exactly as he or she might want it to be. I'm very selfish in that regard. I really went about.
To me, that was a very heartwarming component of this, because it starts when you describe your father treating patients that he had the full range of folks that paid as normal, folks that. Were needy and didn't, and then the super high prestigious one that I'm forgetting which high, who was it? It was King, there was somebody very important that
the Shah.
The Shah.
Shankai-shek, did he?
He saw Madame Chang too, but I was the one who saw Madame Chang in Taiwan.
In Taiwan, but, that was it.
Yeah.
It was so nice to me to see that you'd grown up with this, early 1900s tradition of asking people to pay what's appropriate, and then the whole mix of your experience when you were in graduate school and training to become a doctor, where you had the local community that the Wilmer Institute offered treatment to a large under.
And you've been there. It's an impressive place, isn't it?
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, very much so. And,
yeah,
and
really.
Then that you continued with that down in Texas. It's something that I've never thought about as being possible. You know, you just right now with so much of the community that just looks to their insurance company to pay the bills, and
yeah.
To think that there's still the option for physicians to be very appreciative of the needs of their patients. It was good to read.
You know, thanks. You know, the people say from time to time that one man or one woman can make a difference in the world, and maybe so. And the first experience of uniqueness or singularity to me was when the eye operation was done in Houston, and some guy whom I knew accidentally did an eye transplant, which anybody should know is not a possible thing, because the nerve of the eye is not a nerve, it's a brain track of the brain that can't be spliced. He did it, and that led to the downfall of the department. That's how DeBakey called me and asked if I'd come down there and run the department in Houston. But it was a very mistaken operation, and at first the release of publicity about it was an intentional release. The eye transplant's been done, just like Bernard is doing heart transplants in South Africa and Cooley.
Yes, exactly.
and then they realized that it was a bad thing to have said, so then they tried to back pedal on it and so on. I mean, it was a bad PR thing entirely, but it was, it showed the naiveness of and how one operation can do great detriment to a profession, because it really did stain us. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people in DeBakey, my boss then when I went down there to run a department. He was a great example of what one man can do. My gosh, he was an amazing man. And so was Cooley.
Well, when I think of what you and your father did with the eye bank and then the phaco emulsification system, I mean, both of those things were huge changes in the delivery of eye care. Weren't they really, David?
Absolutely big. And phaco emulsification, you know, you use that word so easily. Allison may not be familiar with it, but and certainly a lot of people who may be listening. Phaco emulsification is a surgical technique that was invented by a man named Charles Kellman. And what do you think about putting a postscript on the end of a memoir and then having that postscript be 34 pages or something like that about another person, not even about yourself? I mean, it would seem like it's unfaithful to the commitment of writing a memoir. But for me, I thought, gosh, this is the memoir. But I'm now going to explain it before I even allow you to make a comment. I'd built up by explanation all the vernacular of what it was about, and then I wanted to tell about this really unusual man named Charles Kellman in New York and what he was doing and then what he accomplished and what effect it had on me and on Orbis. Amazing what he did. But it had to be a memoir it had to be at the end of a memoir because it wasn't about me, it was about him. Did you find that forgivable?
Oh, I thought it was wonderful. You know, frankly, I mean, I thought it was both gracious and well-deserved, whether people really realized how condemned he had been by his own profession. But you know, in the book, I thought, you know, you brought that forward and then truly graciously said what a contribution he'd made.
Oh, boy, did he ever. But I was in the enemy's side because I was a full-time academic and he was in practice. And Charlie was a very brash guy. You know, he played the saxophone, and he was a stand-up comedian, did a lot of things that a lot of eye doctors don't find themselves doing, actually don't have the talent to do, even flying his own helicopter, which he took me on his helicopter out to see his patients and watch him operate out in New Jersey because he was sort of thrown out of his hospitals in New York. But I mean, he was just one of a kind. He just yesterday, I heard from another neighbor of mine, Chris Brody, who's now the head of the foundation that gave him his final tribute, that he's the first person who's received that posthumously,
the Lasker.
The
Lasker.
The Lasker.
I thought that, I didn't know that, so I thought that was really nice.
There's never been another. Well,
I thought it was a nice addition to the idea of an autobiography, because in some sense it tells us more about you by letting us see
exactly,
into who you respect.
Exactly, Alice. Yeah.
Well, thank you. This sounds sort of like a vanilla thing to say, but one of the things I've learned in a medical career is that that to have everybody else be a hero is one of the most pleasing attitudes one can have. I loved my patients and my colleagues and others, but beyond that, I guess I was a tremendous admirer of other people who could do things that I couldn't do, and that was very, very common to find. I really feel that I went through life with a very average mind, and one that had this plague in it called dyslexia, and it wasn't even recognized when I was in school and even in college, but it sure was taking its number on me. So.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, actually. It turns out there's a large number of engineers that have dyslexia, and I'm not sure. I don't understand
really?
The brain well enough to know, but I do know that it's a common enough challenge that is impressive when people overcome it, because there's certainly easier ways out than pushing yourself as needed to overcome it. And I know now there's more and more approaches to take to learning in spite of dyslexia, but when you were coming through the ranks, have to believe
I was coming through the ranks, I didn't know beans about it. When I wrote about it interpretively years later, I explained it as I think it really happened. But just briefly, I want to repeat that because it's sort of, to me, it's important for people to know who have dyslexia or whose family members have it or their children have it. And it's this: dyslexia, no question about it, slows you down, and differently. People don't speak about a spectrum of dyslexia. Some people get severely affected and others less so. But it's not just the severity, it's the location on the spectrum. For example, some people have much worse spelling and reading, very, very, very slow. Some people have mathematical troubles. Some people don't have any math. My son's very dyslexic, but he's much better in mathematics than I am. But math was one of my big downfalls. But here, just briefly, I just want to say this, that because one has that impediment, when that impediment is combined with ambition, and God, I had ambition to prove myself because I had such, I think, worthy relatives, and I'd be damned if I wasn't going to be able to compete with them on my own, so to speak. That ambition plus dyslexia leads to the only out that I think the right brain that isn't affected has, and that's originality or creativity. And I developed creativity, and that was my big thing, starting in college and throughout medicine. I think almost anybody who knows me today would say that was my strength. Not my smarts and other things, not my great memory, not there were a lot of things that I was not. I don't even want to tell you them all. But I was not a person who could do so many other people's gifted things, but I was good at creativity, and that's where Orbis came in. But there were other examples. I gave a few of them in the book.
I think that's frequently the way you find that men, both scientists and physicians, often have a side that exhibits that creativity as well as, you know, the saxophone player in the Kelman place or the,
I see what you're saying. You don't have to have the dyslexia. Well, for me, I had to have the dyslexia, but Kelman is interesting. Charlie Kelman wanted to be famous. He wrote a memoir also, and he said that's really his goal. It's rather interesting. It's very frank. It's not like saying, I want to help everybody, I want to do this or that. He wanted to make an eye operation that would affect the entire world. He did. But he gives us his reason because he wanted to be famous. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Because most people realize that's sort of 15 minutes of fame. But for Charlie, it was a need that he had. He came from a background of people his people from Brooklyn who were certainly not advantaged by any means, and his father in particular was the person who was substantially driving him. He said, Charlie, you can take a year off if you want to be a musician, and then I'm going to tell you at the end of that year whether you're any good. Charlie studied very hard to be a high-powered clarinetist or no, a saxophone player, and at the end of the time, his father said, play me a piece, and Charlie paid him a piece, darn good, very, very good, and he said, is that greatness? And Charlie said, well, I guess maybe not. His father said, you're right, you'd be a doctor, and he was.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds so simplistic, but that's the way Charlie tells the story. But the search to be world famous, and he was, he succeeded in that aim, but in addition to that, he also solved the world for the very best means of cataract extraction that's ever been done. And I hope that the book makes cataract extraction more understandable and rational and also appreciative, that people can appreciate it because it's a very delicate operation. Some people say, oh, you just go in, you know, you have it and you come home, walk home. It's so delicate. A half of a millimeter makes a tremendous difference, can lead to permanent blindness if it's in the wrong direction. And that's why, for the first time in the history of surgery of any kind, when microsurgery came in, it had to be taught by hands-on, by your teacher had to have hands on your hands. And that's why we needed an airplane. I mean, that's the only reason.
I found that so, so interesting. And how difficult was it to teach something like microsurgery to these surgeons in foreign lands?
Not really very difficult. May I tell you one
thing? And to bring that equipment along?
Yeah, but that was the thing. First, I thought, well, we should have some trunks and stuff, and we'd fly them around from one city to city and go to the main hospital and operate. But you can't do it that easily. There are factions of doctors, and if you go to one person's hospital, they don't come to you in the other, and they don't. There's not much cross-fertilization of groups in other countries. And also, the operating rooms often didn't have the facilities for the lights and the audiovisual stuff that was needed for optimal teaching. So the airplane came to that really perfectly.
I thought that was.
I want to just say briefly one thing. When you talk about whether they had the qualifications to learn, I went to Bombay not too many years ago to operate. Well, it was exactly too many years, about 19. It was in the early 80s. That sounds not fair. And I was asked to come demonstrate corneal transplant surgery and lecture in it. And I did, and these people were gathered all around, these young guys, enthusiasts, and they were practically leaning on my shoulders while they watched the operation. And they said, ooh, ah, that's marvelous, ooh, ooh. And then they wanted to ask questions, and they did. And it was, the operation took me about maybe, I don't know, 40 minutes. And it was all sutured up, and then I was very delighted by it. And then the head man said to you, Dr. Payton, would you mind, or would you be interested in staying just for a minute or two to just have a look at our boys? They'd like that a lot. See, you know, they'll do some surgery for you. And they have a long list today, so they want to be started. I said, well, yeah, I guess I've got time. Well, I went back to see these people who had been leaning over my shoulders, and they were like magicians. They were so sensational with their hands and with instruments that were much rougher than I could have used. And it was the most disquieting and yet pleasing experience when you see them, what they really can do. And then all you have to do is show them a new technique and they pick it up rapidly. So therefore, the answer to your question is that, yes, they have that capacity and they've showed it in every country.
Yeah,
I'm probably talking much too much. I'm sorry.
Actually, no. I want to hear more. It's just like reading the book. I could always use another chapter here and there. It's like, oh, tell me more. One of the pieces that you were just alluding to that I found, well, actually, two pieces I'm going to talk about. One was I really appreciated that you included all the little background of your growing up experiences because you say that it was your creativity that allowed your great experiences to take place. But there's also, it struck me that you talked about the experience with wanting to take the clarinet lessons and wanting to be in front of people and then wanting to, your experiences with Jim Baker and wanting to be, if he was going to be treasurer, you were going to be a VP. So there's some piece of you that's enjoyed success, success in itself. Helps
no
helps
question
you want more success.
No question.
So maybe you could talk
a
little bit about that. And then I've got another question about all these international experiences. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how success helped drive you to want more success, if there was a piece of this.
Well, I don't understand that quite. If you have some success, do you keep wanting more and more success? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. It was. It looked like it was just sort of fun. That it was. Okay. Hey, I can do this. I'm the vice president of my.
Yeah.
I guess it was at your
I think that's true. You're right. Nothing was ever. I think that's characteristic for everybody. You get up closer and closer to the goal that you seek. You feel finally that you're sort of there, but then you realize there's so much more to be done. There's other stuff that's a challenge. That everything's incomplete, and what one strives for is satisfaction. I think I ended the book on that word satisfaction, more or less, because I said it's an individual decision. It's made subconsciously. For me, I had the extra pleasure of thinking that what I'd created was not with my hands. That was just a very small part of it. It was the multiplier effect, in which I was effective in helping the multiplier effect reach out to the millions of blind people that exist and still exist in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a satisfaction more like an engineering satisfaction, Allison, than it is the average doctor's satisfaction when he is more limited just to his own practice. I don't mean to belittle that. It's very important. But it's just that I found another dimension that, for me, was more fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. No, actually, I think I saw that, too, even when you talked about the decision to go into practice or academics. And
yeah, that's right. That was hard.
It was like it's a new challenge to push yourself to, and you did.
Yeah.
And you looked for the next one. So.
Yeah, that
and
was hard,
I
must say.
And the creativity to even conceive of a flying eye hospital. Oh, that's quite something, David.
That was by ruling out everything else.
Yeah.
And, you know, I may have been the founder and first medical director, but that was a project by consensus and by many people. I mean, there was so little I knew about the aircraft industry, and so little the aircraft industry knew about medicine, that it was a meeting. But on the other hand, I think some of the greatest steps forward that mankind has is often when two different fields get together, an engineering or aeronautical
mm-hmm.
engineering and medicine. That's what it really was in this case.
Mm-hmm.
It was. I really only touched the surface of the problems it was to try to figure out how to get potable water at airports and abroad, how to have enough electricity, what are we going to do about fueling the aircraft, what do you do about vibrations.
I loved your story about having to use a hacksaw to get the first plug to work.
Oh, yeah. That was, it was so embarrassing because they had a whole bunch of VIPs from Houston, including Mrs. Bush, and there was a pause, and the doctors and the staff, of course, knew that there was a pause, but the surgeon was very smart. He kept talking, and as he did, he indicated that he'd have to take off his gloves and re-scrub, I can't remember actually if he put on another pair of gloves over top, but what he did, he got a hacksaw and he took off that extra little prong, and then it plugged into a regular plug, and it went on because he couldn't work without it. And it could have been, you know, I have to say, we're so sorry we can't go on with this operation that you've all waited all day for.
Yeah.
Anyway, and our first
operation.
You said
that so well in the last part of your chapter of your book. When you say whatever the undertaking, it is only accomplished by the collaboration of many heads and hearts working in
unison. Yeah, that's what I want to say. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really is true. And how many took part in your endeavors?
Did you think I was a little bit too serious throughout the thing, or contrary wise, did I seem flip with some of the stories that I couldn't resist telling?
Well, for me, I thought it was wonderful. I loved the personal part of it, and I gather you did too.
certainly did. I mean, in retrospect, for example, when we were in Taiwan and about my wet socks. I mean,
yes,
I
love
that.
It. falling off as you went.
Happened. Oh, God, I could look back and just roar with laughter thinking about it, but at the time, I was not roaring. I was, God, I was so embarrassed. 40 years old and my first major assignment, so to speak, and in a foreign country when, in which I was completely independent, and I totally goofed it, I guess. Anyway, it's sort of weird.
Well, that one worked out. It was fun, your concluding remark about it. She had a photographer waiting in the wings, so she'd already decided.
Yeah, right.
You never know.
Right. Yeah, she certainly put her... She put her doctors through a real pace that day, because first she said, how in the world would you be doing corneal transplants without official permission from me, I think she wanted to be saying. And and the guy just blanched. I've never seen him so scared. And then she, after talking to him in Chinese, which I didn't pick up, obviously, then she said in English, yes, I want to congratulate you for your farsightedness and blah, blah, blah. And he just smiled at last. And it was a, she, you know, she was referred to, there have been some wonderful books about her, her charm and her education, her smarts. But also there were some pretty devious things that she did in her life. She and her sisters, remarkable family. Remarkable.
Actually, that to me was a, it was a different side of the book that I hadn't expected at all, which was your, had such a variety of international experiences and sort of fitting into the cultural, for, you know, the aspects that one wouldn't even think needed to be addressed. Everything from, you had that one where you were out eating a sheep.
Sheep eye. Oh,
sheep eye.
Yeah, somebody just recently told me that they'd had the same experience. It's sort of like it's a maneuver that many foreigners are subjected to in the Arab countries, and I didn't realize it at the time. But before I went there, but God, that was a bad experience for
an eye doctor. But to an eye surgeon who's retrieving corneas.
Oh God, it was just horrible. And the other horrible thing was when I was caught and put on the mat for it. And,
yes, I thought that was a wonderful tale, David, that readers would truly enjoy. But I mean, how hard it is to be doing good and then suddenly to be brought up short. But the Shah helped you out there.
Yeah, well, certainly Bobby Daugherty, Bob Daugherty was a classmate of your husband's and mine at Princeton, and he was the guy who knew the contact in Lebanon, who could get in touch with the guy, the doctor in the palace, and blah blah blah. You know, I don't want to go through it all, but that's. But that was a stirring thing for me, to be so-called stealing eyes at the request of a nun, and then being turned in for it was bad enough. What do you think? Do you think that I used blindness effectively as a kind of metaphor in my book, in which the author is trying to seek satisfaction through emerging from some oppression of one kind or another, the relief of blindness was something was so much on my agenda that I was so accustomed to people with blindness that I, in a sense, was blinded and needed a recuperation, and I finally got it in that. And those last pages, I hope at least, sound as exultant as one dared write without being a total kid, using great exciting words and lots of exclamation points. I mean, it really, that's the way it ended for me at that point.
The satisfaction, David.
Yeah, it was. It was
the second sight and seeing that you had come so far and the good that's been done.
Yeah. It's a, you know, and I think we're sort of winding up here. I just want to say this, that being an eye doctor, and other kinds of doctors too, you get people thanking you an awful lot. Even men that appreciate it can't speak the same language, and they kiss your hand. Poor souls from the desert or from some slum, but their eyes and their face, they give expression of gratitude, and that is about as selfish as one can be if you want it time after time. And there's a need that grows in you for that. And it's really a welcome need, but it is nevertheless a need. And so when I call it my selfish life. I really think it was, because that was part of the quest that one has. It's the satisfaction of feeling that you're justifying your training and justifying confidence of others and whatever.
I felt that was a very late thing for you, that realization that satisfaction
was
there.
Yeah, it was the second sight.
You know, that the rest of the time you basically were striving for that.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Well, pushing yourself to do good as opposed to appreciating the good being done.
That's the way I felt.
Listen, I have a feeling that I've exhausted you enough. I'm so afraid that all of a sudden you're going to start giving me horrible things you can say what I forgot to say. So because you've been so exalted about this, I'd rather just say, now we have to respect our 40 minutes. And I want to thank you both immensely, because on very short notice you did some. You were both wonderful, Marcia and Allison. And I also want to thank Tyson and Christina from Rare Bird, and I can't even remember at the moment the name of the corporation whose book thing we're using. It's goodreads.com. So maybe that's where you should go. And this will be on recording. But for those who are listening in, I'd just like to say the book's name, the book's name is Second Sight, Views from an Eye Doctor's Odyssey, and it has a website that's in the process of change, but it's pretty good so far. It's called Second Sight Book, all one word, secondsightbook.com. So thank everybody so much for listening, and we're going to be on next week at the same time for the number two blog, and it can't be as good as this one. Thank you, Marcia.
It's a privilege, David. Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye, Allison.
Bye-bye. Thanks, all.
Left you on the debris at the Sunday morning market. You were starting to the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door.